This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We have great needs in terms of repairing infrastructures that were looted, that were destroyed, and the lack of supplies in certain areas makes it also very difficult for children to get health services, to get immunization.
That was UNICEF's representative in Ethiopia, Gianu Franco Rotogalino, on how the humanitarian situation in the Tigray region is improving, but the needs remain immense. Details coming up. Also, Pope Francis has urged the people and leaders of Congo and South Sudan to forge new paths of reconciliation, peace, and development. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The West African bloc ECOWAS has lifted economic and financial sanctions against Mali's military government after it vowed to hold elections in February 2024. The move was welcomed by many Malians who have been struggling under restrictions and the global rise in fuel and food costs. Annie Rasenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
Early Monday morning, Bamako's Grand Marché, or Central Market, slowly comes to life. On Sunday evening, regional bloc ECOWAS announced the immediate lifting of economic and financial sanctions against Mali, following a summit in Accra, Ghana. The sanctions, imposed in January after military leaders delayed elections until 2026, were lifted after leaders announced a new election timetable in June, with elections in 2024. Mali is a landlocked country and depends on its ECOWAS neighbors for trade. The economic sanctions prohibited the trade of goods and closed borders between Mali and its neighbors, with exceptions for food, fuel, and medicine. Moussa Suarde sells clothing in Bamako's Grand Marché out of a small kiosk. He says his merchandise comes from Senegal, Benin, and Nigeria, all countries that were cut off from Mali during the sanctions. Taking a small break from speaking to clients, he says the sanctions made an already difficult situation worse.
Tout le monde travaille un peu. Pour trouver quelque chose.
Everyone works a little bit here and there to make a living, he says. Especially here. It's a poor country. Our merchandise, it's not made here. We don't have those factories here. In Bamako's Assé de Mille neighborhood, a group of motorcycle taxi drivers gathered near a roundabout waiting for dispatches. Seydou Koulibaly says he only began driving a motorcycle taxi, which pays little, because of a lack of available work in Mali. He says he hopes the lifting of sanctions will open up the country to more investment and more jobs. He says the sanctions were implemented and we had a lot of difficulties. Different products became expensive, and there was also the rise in gas prices. Though fuel was not subject to sanctions, gasoline prices have risen in Mali recently as they have worldwide. Political analyst and political science professor Kalilou Sidibe says that though the lifting of sanctions is a turn in the right direction, it's too early to say how the 2024 elections plan will play out. For the moment, he says, the sanctions have been lifted. But the international community is watching the government. How will they proceed? How will concrete progress be made on the ground? It's only after all of this that confidence can be reestablished, he says. The military government, which first took power in a 2020 coup, originally promised elections in February of 2022. It delayed elections in December 2021, citing lack of security. Sidibe added that the management of Mali's rampant insecurity will be an important issue for the junta and their ability to hold elections as promised. With the lifting of sanctions, ECOWAS member states' ambassadors will be able to return to Bamako. During the summit, ECOWAS leaders also agreed to a 24-month transition to civilian rule in neighboring Burkina Faso, which has also been under military rule since January. Burkina Faso and Mali have both seen increasing Islamist violence under military rule. Annie Rasenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Suspected Islamic extremists have killed at least 27 people in two attacks in northern Burkina Faso. The French news agency AFP, quoting security officials, reports that about 15 people, some of them children, were killed late Sunday at Bourasso in Kossi, the country's province. 12 people died also on Saturday in an attack at Namsi Guima in Yatenga province. Three of the dead were members of a civilian militia, the Volunteers of the Defense of the Fatherland, an auxiliary force set up in December 2019 to support the army. Burkina Faso, one of the world's poorest countries, has been grappling with an extremist insurgency that swept in from the neighboring Mali in 2015. The campaign, led mainly by groups linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group, has claimed thousands of lives and forced some 1.9 million people to flee their homes. More than 40% of the country lies outside the control of the government, according to official figures. Burkina Faso underwent a coup in January when disgruntled colonels ousted elected President Roch Marc Christian Kabore. A senior UNICEF official says humanitarian aid is flowing into previously inaccessible areas in northern Ethiopia's embattled Tigray region. He says life-saving aid is reaching hundreds of thousands of people in need thanks to the government's humanitarian truce with the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Researchers at Ghent University in Belgium estimate as many as 500,000 people have died from war, starvation, and other indirect causes in Tigray. This since Ethiopian military forces invaded the region November 4, 2020, in response to attacks by the Tigray People's Liberation Front. In an interview with VOA from his office in Addis Ababa, UNICEF's representative in Ethiopia, Gianfranco Rotigliano, says there's been a change since the government truce was declared in March. He says 170 trucks rolled into previously blockaded areas in April and expects that number to increase to more than 1,000 trucks a month. Rotigliano describes the needs as immense. He says more than 5 million people in Tigray require international aid, as well as an additional 7 million people in the conflict-affected Amhara and Afar regions.
We have great needs in terms of repairing infrastructures that were looted, that were destroyed, and the lack of supplies in certain areas makes it also very difficult for children to get health services, to get immunization. Many schools are closed, so children cannot go to school, and there are more risk for exploitation and sexual abuse in the region.
UNICEF estimates nearly 400,000 children in northern Ethiopia are malnourished. It says 80,000 severely malnourished children have been treated for this life-threatening condition this year, compared to 36,500 during the same period last year, indicating a seriously deteriorating situation. Rotigliano tells VOA priority needs include food, seed, and fertilizers, as well as cash to pay civil servants, doctors, nurses, and other essential workers who receive no salary. He says another critical issue is fuel, which is in short supply.
This is a big problem, because fuel is not an issue of Ethiopia, it's a global issue, as you know. With the war in Ukraine, the prices of fuel have gone up, and the supply of fuel has decreased. So this is a big issue that we are facing now.
Rotigliano warns the distribution of life-saving aid to millions of people in Tigray will be severely affected if fuel supplies run out. UN agencies estimate 100 trucks carrying food, medicine, non-food items, and fuel must arrive in Tigray every day to meet the region's humanitarian needs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council details how a militia run by seven brothers executed and imprisoned hundreds of people between 2016 and 2020 in the Libyan town of Tarahuna. Based on testimony from residents and two site visits, the mission has found reasonable grounds that the Kaniyat militia was responsible. The report calls it the most egregious example of human rights abuse in Libya's turbulent period since Muammar Gaddafi was ousted in 2011. Reuters reported that the Kenyat militia was once aligned with the Tripoli-based government of National Accord, then switched and aligned itself with the Eastern Libyan National Army led by Commander Khalifa Haftar that tried unsuccessfully to overthrow the National Accord administration. Already, Libyan authorities have recovered 247 bodies en masse and individual gravesites in the Tarhuna area in western Libya. Many had been handcuffed and blindfolded. The mission used satellite imagery showing signs of soil disturbance, among other evidence, to identify three new likely sites. But there could be many more, it said, citing an existing grave known as the landfill, where just a tiny fraction of the site has been investigated. The surviving leaders of the Kanyat militia are mostly believed to have fled to areas of eastern Libya under Haftar's control. Protests have followed Senegal's announcement that opposition candidate from the Yawi Askanwis national candidate list would be left off the electoral rolls for elections later this month. Gilles Yabi, a political analyst and founder of the Wati think tank in West Africa, spoke to Ricky Shryock about the protests and power struggles in Senegalese elections.
It's now quite clear that there were some mistakes and inconsistency in the decision that were made, first by the ministry in charge of organizing elections and also by the Constitutional Council. I think it is more troubling that the Constitutional Council decided to validate the list of the main candidates and basically separate the list of what we call in French titulaire, so the main candidate to the legislative elections, and the list of those who are there to replace actually the candidate if something happened during the legislature. So it is a move which is not really understood by most of experts of law and of electoral processes in Senegal and in the region. And I think that tells a lot about the weakening of the institutions more generally. The electoral institution and also key institutions like the Constitutional Council, which is not giving a very good signal to the population.
This weakening of the institutions, the electoral institutions, can you tell me more about that? And was this done specifically by Macky Sall and his government?
I don't think that is necessarily only a political move, and that it is in this case there was a decision, political decision, to try and prevent the opposition, one of the list of the opposition, from participating to the elections. I'm afraid that we have a combination of lack of political neutrality by some of the institutions in the country, but also problem of incompetence or just a weakening of human resources and capacity also of some institution and more generally also public administration in the country. So I would not say that it's only all of this is only the result of the governance of Macky Sall. I think that there was a trend since President Abdoulaye Wade of the weakening of political institutions.
How do these legislative elections and the fact that a major opposition party has been left off of the electoral rolls, will that influence the presidential election scheduled for 2024?
The way the politics works for now in Senegal, a very important election is the presidential election. The president is really the one who has the power, and National Assembly tend to be quite weak. So the real stakes behind this legislative election is actually presidential election of 2024. The issue of the possibility of Macky Sall to be candidate again for a third mandate is something which is in the minds. There is no confirmation of that, but there is no indication as well that it's excluded. And the result of the legislative election would give a signal either that President Macky Sall might be want to be candidate again, and we have the kind of political support that is necessary to move in that direction, or the opposition wins the legislative elections or have a kind of a strong result, and that would make it almost impossible for President Macky Sall to even envision to be candidate again.
That was Gilles Yabi, founder of Wati, a citizen think tank of West Africa. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note that we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Hope Francis has urged the people and leaders of Congo and South Sudan to turn a page and forge new paths of reconciliation, peace, and development. Francis issued a video message Saturday, the day he had planned to begin a week-long pilgrimage to the two African countries. He canceled the trip last month because of knee pain that makes walking and standing difficult. In the message, Francis said he was greatly disappointed to not be able to travel and promised to visit as soon as possible. The Catholic Church has always played a role in Congo, especially in the establishment of democracy and advocacy for human rights. The church deployed about 40,000 electoral observers in the 2019 election that brought Felix Tshisekedi to the presidency. Tshisekedi, an opposition figure, defeated then-President Joseph Kabila's chosen candidate in Congo's first peaceful democratic transfer of power since independence from Belgium in 1960. There were high hopes for peace and stability once South Sudan gained its long-fought independence from Sudan, but it slid into ethnic violence in December 2013. A 2018 peace deal that binds President Salva Kiir and his deputy Riek Machar in a unity government encourages authorities to hold elections before February 2023. As Europe seeks to wean itself off Russian natural gas, Algeria, Niger and Nigeria have revived a decade-old multi-billion dollar gas project. The Trans-Saharan Gas Pipeline could send up to 30 billion cubic meters of gas per year to Europe from Nigeria to Algeria and on to Europe. Analysts note the project faces many challenges, as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
Nigeria's petroleum minister Timipre Silva said funding for the project will come from Europe and that authorities are already holding talks with European firms and countries. Silva said a committee set up by the countries was already conducting a feasibility study to build a 4,128-kilometer-long gas pipeline from southern Nigeria to Algeria via Niger. The landmark decision to revive the Trans-Saharan Gas Pipeline Project, TSGP, followed a two-day joint meeting held in Abuja last week by petroleum authorities from the three African nations. The committee will meet at the end of July. Revival of the project was lauded by the African Energy Chamber, a group that promotes cross-border cooperation in the continent's energy industry. More praise comes from Abuja-based energy expert Emmanuel Afiami.
It actually shows that Africa is trying as much as possible to position itself to possibly see how well they can help Europe cover the energy demand issue. Beyond this, this particular project would actually mean a lot for the three African countries involved. The benefit to the local economy.
The initiative was initially conceived more than 40 years ago, but renewed interest comes amid Russia's war on Ukraine and efforts by Europe to slash Russia's energy income. African energy experts like Afiami say that with demand for natural gas rising, the TSGP project could transform Africa's energy future if properly implemented. Public finance analyst Isaac Botti says political will has been a challenge and still...
For me, I think the major challenge is the political will of these countries to embark on this huge project. For example, the pipeline project between Nigeria to Ghana, which have also been stalled over the time, was as a result of political will, not non-availability of resources to do that. Part of the problem is also the fact that we are reliant on easy money.
In April, EU delegates met with Nigerian officials in Abuja and held talks about diversifying Europe's sources of energy. Earlier in June, Nigerian authorities directed state-run oil company Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, NNPC, to implement a deal on a gas pipeline to Europe through Morocco. Authorities are also planning to transport more gas from southern to northern Nigeria and build a major gas turbine in Abuja. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Employees refusing to work and customers refusing to pay for electricity. Those are just two of the many problems affecting South Africa's national power company, Eskom. Long electricity outages are costing Africa's second largest economy billions of dollars every few days in lost production and is starting their third week. Darren Taylor reports.
A commission of inquiry has found that former President Jacob Zuma appointed cronies to loot Eskom during the last 4 years of his tenure, between 2014 and 2018, allegations that he denies. But former Eskom managers say the rot began in the late 1990s. That's when the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, began retrenching experienced technical personnel and replacing them with party loyalists. ANC governments also failed to ensure that old infrastructure was replaced. And when they provided money for new power stations, the projects were allegedly racked with corruption and hampered by substandard equipment. In some parts of the country, blackouts are now lasting 11 hours a day. Eskom switches the lights off in stages it calls load shedding. It says the outages are getting worse because many workers responsible for maintaining power stations are striking illegally. Unions insist workers aren't to blame and that so-called historic issues are causing electricity meltdown.
To suggest that the sudden ramping up of load shedding is not because the workers are on strike is absolutely nonsensical.
Andrew Levies, a labour law specialist.
The workers have ignored the law. They have shown utter contempt for the Labour Relations Act, which the unions were all party to. They have ignored a court interdict. Now, obviously, the unions themselves want to distance themselves from that, because if they're seen to be in support, well, they might even make themselves liable for some sort of punitive damages.
The Congress of South African Trade Unions says workers have been forced to go on an unprotected strike because Eskom management isn't listening to their grievances. Spokesperson Matthew Parks says maintenance crews want shorter shifts and higher wages.
We shouldn't be blaming workers for the crisis at Eskom. Eskom has been in a crisis for 20 years because we failed to invest in new generation capacity 20 years ago as we rolled out electrification, as the population and the economy grew. It has been a crisis because of the decade of state capture and corruption, where we literally saw Eskom being stripped to the ground through mismanagement, through looting, of many, many decades of neglect and at times criminal mismanagement of Eskom taking place.
While that's true, says Levy, workers and their unions should bear a lot of responsibility for the current blackouts.
This strike has taken place before the negotiations had been completed. Deadlock had not been reached. Good faith bargaining says you declare the dispute when neither side has any further movement. And of course, the strike takes place. It's an extension of collective bargaining. And sooner or later, one side will offer to move its position.
Eskom representative Amanda Kriti says power cuts are intensifying because the utility can't buy much of the new equipment it needs as customers across the country refuse to pay their bills.
That was Darren Taylor reporting on South Africa's national power company, Eskom. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.